Braincast, directly from my brain to your ears. We are connected to Freya Bales, a music lecturer at the University of Hull. She's an oboe player with a research interest in all aspects of psychology of music. Her doctoral thesis was musical imagery, hearing and imagining music, which explored the nature and prevalence of musical imagery. Freya Bales, have you been working in the field recently?
Yes, I haven't done as much work in the area as I would like, but my interest is still there, and it's mostly that I have plans. I have plans to move a little bit more into how people use musical imagery creatively. So right now, I've been fortunate to just be working on editing a special issue on musical imagery, which you should take a look at, a special issue of the journal Psychomusicology, which is coming out very soon. So I've mostly been doing sort of convening other researchers and looking at the field more generally rather than conducting primary research recently, although I do have a paper coming out which is following up on my work from 2006 and 2007, which is when I use what's called experience sampling methods to essentially send text messages to people's phones at random times throughout the day to ask them, are you hearing music or are you imagining music right now? What's your mood? What are you doing? Who are you talking to? Why do you think you might be imagining that music? And I've been trying to explore a little bit more of the idea that maybe there's something that we call mood congruence when people imagine music compared to when they hear music. Specifically, do they feel the same way when they're imagining a particular song, for example, as when they hear that particular song? And one of the reasons I'm interested in this question is because I really want to try and understand why we walk around imagining music. And one theory is that perhaps we do so to regulate our emotions. If you think about it, being able to imagine music is a very convenient, practical way of regulating our own mood. We don't need any props. We can just use our own imagination to recreate an emotional mood congruent scenario, which might make us feel the same way that we feel when we hear that same piece of music. So that's one idea that I have at the moment that I explore in this recent paper that's coming out soon. But I'm also really interested increasingly in creative musical imagery. So the sorts of things that you're interested in as a composer and sound artist. Not everybody, as far as I can see, who writes, composes music or sound works really seems to relate particularly well to this idea of imagining music, but other people really do, and I'm very interested in that. And one of my findings in this forthcoming paper is that I was quite surprised by how many people with no musical training at all were reporting that they were imagining their own compositions as they were walking around just in everyday life. And I found that quite intriguing. And so I'd like to begin in the future, I'd like to explore that a little bit more.
Whenever I'm talking to sound artists, musicians, they usually talk about developing their language, their inner musical language. Can you compare like this inner musical language from non-musicians and musicians? Have you looked at that?
I haven't looked at that, no. I did do some work which hasn't been published a long time ago for my master's, where I interviewed an electroacoustic composer because I was very interested in how he might experience imagining sound given his very hands-on, practical, manipulating actual sounds. That's the approach that he took, and I think a lot of electroacoustic composers take. And he spoke in those terms as well. Very much so, but I haven't done any comparison with what let's call them normal people, what they do and what their experience is. I'm not sure that they would use terms like musical language, but I can see how it makes complete sense to people who that's their daily activity. That's what they think about. That's what they explore, I guess.
For everybody, it's very hard to talk about music, like to to find the words of music. And what I have found is like all the musicians being in different fields. As an example, one artist, she's doing a lot of specialization with music, so she's very aware of space and rooms and all that. So her imagination, as she describes it, is very, very much like surround. She can take everything, like she found her own language in that, also in imagination. Depending on where the people are, they have developed a very specific musical language.
Yes, which makes complete sense, doesn't it? I think that's fascinating, the example you describe of having quite a spatial auditory imagination. Something I wondered about for a long time, because thinking about what dimensions of sound make their way into our imagination and which don't. And I think that it makes complete sense to think that what's important to us in the way we experience, if you like, real physical sound is ultimately what is important to our imagination as well. And it seemed to me that for most people, it might be important to know in your physical environment where that lion is that's roaring, or any sort of threat. But in terms of music, most people don't think about spatial representation, and it's only really when we get down to sound artists and people who specialise in deliberately manipulating that as an artistic property that we can start to think, well, that interests me a lot, actually. So how we might think about imagine music in a spatial way. I know I certainly don't, but that's one of the reasons that I got quite interested in looking at how we might imagine loudness or not. And I don't think many people have really given this particularly much thought until recent years, but finding that people are able to do it. When you ask people in an experimental situation to imagine their way through a piece of music that they know very well, that in most recordings or performances would have a lot of dynamic variation, people are actually able to recreate those loudness profiles, if you like, the temporal unfolding of loudness patterns when they imagine that music through. And I think that that's quite interesting too. So yes, I mean, who knows, maybe I should start to research on representing spatial aspects of sound as well. Maybe I need to contact this person you're talking about.
I was reading some of this paper about loudness that you've been writing. And my thought about this is, I myself, I can imagine very much this loudness thing, and most musicians that I've been talking to as well. And what I'm interested in, like, I came across this, this exploding head syndrome, you know, this sudden bursts of sound going on in your head. I would call it like a release of something. People describing it as all neurons firing up at the same time, giving this very loud thunder bomb kind of sound in your head. And like I've had that myself at some point, and it is like very, very loud. Because the thing is, loudness, like when I imagine sound, can't like turn it up to 11, you know. This moment was like a proof that, well, somehow it should be possible.
Yes, interesting. And I think in general the blurring, the crossover between neurological symptoms, let me say, but actually related to pathological conditions, and the crossover with more everyday experience. So I'm thinking hallucinations ranging all the way through to, I think it is fascinating, because what hallucinations tell us and what you're describing tells us, as you say, is exactly that we do have the capacity to interpret internal events or experience them phenomenologically as being to something that we would describe as being generated in the physical external environment. So it's fascinating. I personally think that what's interesting for me with loudness is that I don't really experience it the same way as I experience loudness when I'm hearing music, but that I am able to control the sound to get something that's a little bit like it, but it's still sort of muffled. So it's still muted in some way, even though I might be able to have some variation in loudness when I imagine sound, it still is never going to feel like hearing music for me. But that's my own subjective experience.
Yeah, I've been asking that a lot, if they would describe it like some kind of filtering, and it depended a lot between the musicians as well, yeah.
Yes, and you might have come across some sort of dialogue I had with Andrea Holpen a number of years ago on the subject of timbre and imagining timbre, because as a musician, and perhaps it is as a musician, but maybe, but I think that you don't have to be a musician to experience this, I imagine timbre qualities of sound very vividly indeed, very vividly, whereas at the time that we were having this published debate, her view was that, you know, timbre is something that it perhaps people really don't experience particularly vividly. They don't have a very rich palette of sounds in their mind's ear, if you like. But I profoundly disagree with that, and I think that my research is showing that people do, particularly music that they know very well. So again, I'm not talking about composers necessarily. I'm talking about your everyday person. It's music that they know very well. Their mental image is described as being extremely rich in terms of timbre detail. So again, I think it very much relates to how we treat music, how we relate to music, what's important to us in music, what's important to us in our sound world, and I suspect that that's what makes its way and becomes important in our imaginations.
Did you ever get to a point where you ask people about imagining sub-bass or high-pitched frequencies?
No. I mean, I played with filtering sounds a little bit in an experiment I did, looking at timbre. So I had people listening to some Bjork and some Pulp, and they were supposed to listen to these tracks over and over and over again until they knew inside out. And I had them mentally continuing that music, and then I introduced the song back in again, and it was either at the point that they were expecting or not, and it was either the timbre that they should have been expecting or not. And I used filters in the sound to play with the frequencies and things like that. But no, I haven't spoken to anybody just like that about what their experience is. I'd be interested to know what you found though.
There is some people who would describe the phenomena of sub bass. There's one guy who was saying that he can imagine like high-pitched sounds that are not in the hearing range. So, well, what are you going to do with that? But it was interesting because like my thoughts was, at the moment I have like a limitation of high frequencies. It stops around, I don't know, 14K or something. And question would be, is your imagination strong enough to, because I can remember higher pitched tones, but I can't really redo them in my head. It's aging. Imagination is aging. That was my point, I guess.
Yes. Well, I think people get very carried away, don't they? Talking about Beethoven and his reliance on his imagination after hearing loss, and I've wondered about that, sort of how it would change as time goes by, as your memory fades. But it relates again to some of the questions that I'm interested in looking at next, to do with creativity, and I'm interested in how we can imagine something completely new. Is it possible to imagine something that we haven't experienced perceptually? And there's all sorts of ways you can think about that question. But I hadn't thought about it in the terms you've just put it before.
I was talking to a guy who is doing a lot of coding for his music. I wanted to know like what kind of tools, in a sense of manipulation tools, musical manipulation tools, he's got in his head that are not possible yet. he was saying, yeah, he sometimes imagines some kind of algorithm or whatever coding to see if he could reach at some point this idea. In my radio play, maybe going back to this story, like at some point I was doing some research in the neuroscience and stumbling upon some very strange things going on there in the neuroscience, like they did a reconstruction of audio from the brain. So which led me to this idea, okay, like if that's possible in the near future, we just gonna, you know, plug it in and listen to what kind of music we have in our heads. How do you work together with neuroscientists?
I haven't personally, no. I do speak to them because I come into regular contact with them at conferences, and it isn't my field. I was involved in some work which I hadn't thought of in these terms really, but sort of relates, which is looking at sonification of the brain, of brain activity. And I suppose it's just the next step along, and I know that there is research that's been done like this, particularly actually outside of auditory imagery. As usual, visual research is a lot more advanced than our understanding of auditory imagery and musical imagery. I know that there's research using visual imagery where they're actually now using imaginary scenarios to elicit responses from people who have some neurological condition and can't express themselves verbally. And so instead of asking people to sort of tap their fingers once for yes, two times for no in answer to questions to sort of diagnose what's going on in the brain, they're asking people to, if the answer to this question is yes, imagine you're playing tennis. If your answer to the answer to this question is no, imagine some alternative scenario. And brain imaging, as in neuroimaging techniques, are sophisticated enough to show that there's different, very specific neural activation associated with those two separate mental images. And I was thinking the other day about how interesting that would be if you ask people to imagine two alternative songs, for example, or completely different types of music as yes or no equivalents. So if the answer to the question was yes, imagine, I don't know, Happy Birthday. If the answer to the question is no, now imagine, I don't know, I can't think of it, imagine a bird singing or something, and then look for user brain response to identify what their response was to the question. So I know that in a way your radio play seems very futuristic and perhaps a bit out there. It is just a logical extension of what's being done currently, I think. I've been thinking about your idea of, you know, just plugging in to listen to what somebody's imagining. And I think that a deep philosophical and psychological problem with it is that we still wouldn't understand how that was being experienced by the person. Just as we don't understand how people are experiencing what they perceive, physically perceive in the environment. We might all be hearing, you might be hearing that lawnmower outside the way I am. Could be that apart from the signal, you hear it in your mentally in quite a different way to me, just as we all experience colour differently, etc. And if you were to hear somebody's musical imagery, what they have in their mind, that still wouldn't give you that experiential, phenomenological notion of what that is like. So there are some interesting philosophical questions.
What do you think makes sense in the near future for the research? Like you've been telling about your ideas, you were saying that probably it's going closer with neuroscience. How would you see like the future of this kind of research?
Yes, I think that in a way, this is really an academic perspective, but I'm very pleased that the advances in neuroscience are what they are, because I think that as a consequence, those of us who are interested in studying musical imagery in a more behavioural way are taken a lot more seriously It's taken a long time to be acceptable to even talk about imagery, even though visual imagery research has been going on for a long, long time. It's taken a lot of convincing, and I think that part of it is because somehow having tangible so-called evidence of this happens in the brain when XYZ somehow lends the whole field of study credibility, even though my own perspective is that I think we've got a long way to go and it's quite crude, but I think we'll see more and more collaborations, interdisciplinary collaborations between neuroscience and musicians and artists. And we're getting into the realm of being able to scan the brain while people are improvising. And a lot of the research that's been done on perception and thinking about music using neuroscientific techniques, when you really read down to what they're doing and what they're asking people to do when they're lying in an MRI scanner, they're asking them to imagine music. And it's just been taken as being the same as perceiving music. So I think musical imagery research is coming of age, and I think people are beginning to draw it all together, and it's starting to look like a mature and perhaps vaguely respectable research field that there'll be more and more hypotheses that can be tested. So from an academic perspective, I think it's all very encouraging, and I welcome that people are moving from a very exploratory phase into a much more hypothesis-driven way of looking at things. But that doesn't necessarily relate particularly well or sit particularly well with creative aspects. I think that, advances in technology do enable us to take work that otherwise would be completely confined to a laboratory out into the real world more and more increasingly. I mean, how you define real world is relative, but maybe that's the direction that we're going, that we can make it more and more observational and real world. And then what the motive would be for being able to listen into somebody's musical imagery, I'm not sure, outside of a research context and a creative context. I don't know what the implications would be of us arriving at that point in time. I don't know what that would tell us in broader terms about us as human beings and the way we function and what thought is, the very nature of what thought is. Yeah. So just completely speaking off the top of my head there. It's not something I've really thought through, but...